So over the last 5 months, I've been covering each month one of the five precepts. And tonight we're going to finish up. You get the password, the secret handshake, and the t-shirt on the way out. Well, not exactly. I guess I just violated one of the precepts, didn't I? The second one. Anyway, you'll find, I'm sure you noticed, in all the authentic spiritual traditions, there's some kind of ethical standard, ethical teachings or practices that are part of the traditions. And it's no different in Buddhism. What is distinctive about Buddhism from perhaps some of the others is that they're not commandments. There's no thou shalt, and you're going to burn in hell if you mess up. They are practices. And I like to point out that why the precepts are part of the tradition and practice. And when the Buddha gave his original teachings, the first turning of the wheel, he laid out the Four Noble Truths, which basically explains that suffering is part of life. And it's primarily caused by the fact that we want things that we don't have, and we don't want things that we do have. You know, this craving and aversion. There's a way out. And he laid out a pathway, a road map, to find our way out. And it's called the Eightfold Path. And the Eightfold Path is composed of three basic character qualities, or there's the wisdom factors, there's concentration factors, and there's ethical factors. And if you look at each one, they fit into those categories. Well, three of the Eightfold Path are actually very much the same as the precepts. And the way I learned these is that if we wanted to cultivate wisdom or insights and really understand the nature of how things are and free ourselves from delusion, in order to do that, we need to develop some concentration. We need to be able to develop some capacity to focus our awareness on what's going on. So you have the wisdom factors and the concentration factors. And the thing is, it's very difficult to cultivate any kind of concentration, any ability to focus, if we're not living an upright life. If we don't have some kind of moral standard that we operate on. Or as it was explained to me by one of my teachers, it's hard to concentrate when we're robbing banks and wondering when the cops are going to catch us, right? So I just like to lay that out. And the Buddha, he laid out the five precepts. And now if you become a monastic, there's a lot more than five. There's 227, is it? So five, we're getting off easy, right? Now, the first one is basically abstaining from taking life. The second is abstaining from telling lies. The third is not indulging in any kind of sexual misconduct. Actually, the second one is, I got that screwed up. The first one is not taking life. The second one is not taking that which is freely offered, or not stealing. The third is abstaining from sexual misconduct. And the fourth is right speech, not telling lies. So we've covered these. And the last one is, I undertake the training rule to abstain from fermented and distilled intoxicants, which are the basis for heedlessness. That's how it was laid out. So we're going to explore that tonight. And the first thing I want to say is, within practicing Buddhists, there is not a lot of agreement on how to practice this precept. There are some very different points of view about what it means to practice the fifth precept. So we'll talk about that. And also, This precept has a lot more to do than just abstaining from intoxicants. It's more than just not drinking alcohol, which back in the Buddhist day, that was pretty much the issue, was alcohol. I don't think they had any meth labs back in his day, you know. So according to the renowned translator, scholar, and American Theravada Buddhist, Bhikkhu Bodhi, violating the precept requires, first of all, having an intoxicant, two, having an intention to take the intoxicant, three, the actual activity of ingesting the intoxicant, and then the actual ingestion of it. So in other words, I guess if you spit it out, it doesn't count. Or if you don't inhale. Remember that one? So, for example, taking medication that has alcohol, opiates, or other intoxicants is, for genuine medical purposes, is not a violation of the precepts. So the Buddha said there are six dangers of drinking alcohol or violating this precept: loss of wealth, increase of quarrels, ill health, a bad reputation, making a fool of oneself, and impaired intelligence. And I can verify, as someone who indulged heavily, it's like, oh yeah, check, check, check. Yeah, I hit them all. Yeah, all of those. I definitely dealt with those consequences. In the Dhammapada, the Buddha warns, the person who drinks alcohol digs up his own root in this world. So what does it mean to dig up your own root? So we're going to explore this. And here's a key point, that there are, besides, you know, personal and social disadvantages, the main point often stressed in the Buddhist tradition says that if we break the fifth precept and we ingest intoxicants, they can easily lead to breaking the others. And there's plenty of evidence of that. So if we're loaded, the chance of not telling the truth, taking something that is not freely offered, taking life, and engaging in some kind of sexual misconduct, the chances are much greater. And we've seen this, and hopefully, well, not hopefully, perhaps had our own experience of that as well. So there's a story. It's the story of the mountaintop. There was a monk who was living in a mountain cave practicing meditation. You know, these guys are always living in a cave. They're not in a condo. They're not living over a garage in Encino, California. You know, they're in a cave up on a mountain, right? So he had a benefactor down below who would bring up food from time to time to support the monk's practice. Well, as these stories often do, he had a beautiful daughter, and sometimes he would be too tired, the benefactor, so he'd ask the daughter to bring up the supplies. And over time, she became very smitten with this monk, and eventually she suggested to the monk that she'd like to marry him. And the monk said, well, I couldn't possibly do that. I'm a celibate monk. You know, I'm sorry. Well, she was pretty disappointed, and she returned back down the mountain. The next time she went up the mountain, she brought a goat to offer the monk, and she suggested that they could slaughter the goat and have a feast. Oh, I can't do that. I'm a Buddhist monk. First precept, I can't take life. I can't kill a living being. So she shrugged her shoulders, went back down the mountain. The next time she returned with a big jug of Tibetan beer, which is known as Chang. And she said, okay, you cannot marry me and you cannot kill, but surely you can drink. And the monk pondered, well, of all the precepts, the fifth is really the least important. It's the least harmful of the five precepts to drink this Chang. So he said, okay, we can have some chang together. And so they did. You know where this is going, right?
Downhill.
Literally, yeah. So of course, the monk could not control himself, got completely drunk. In the process, he first broke the third precept of celibacy, sexual misconduct, for monks. Then, feeling hungry, he saw a chicken, decided to have it for food. So he killed it, broke the second precept of stealing, because it wasn't his chicken, and the first precept of killing. And the next morning, when the neighbor asked if he'd seen his missing chicken, what chicken? I didn't see a chicken. So thus the monk ended up breaking all the five precepts because he thought the fifth precept on abstaining from intoxicants was the least important part of the practice. So there's an old Tibetan saying, first man takes the bottle, then the bottle takes the bottle, and finally the bottle takes the man. I think they also say that in AA, maybe. I don't know. More or less. So who here, and you don't have to raise your hands, but who here has made some poor decisions under the influence? Oh, we have volunteers. Two hands. Okay.
Who hasn't?
Wow, we work an honest program here. So let's talk about the disagreement. I said before that there's not complete agreement on what it means to follow the precept. Well, you know, there's different lineages and different traditions in Buddhism. You have the Theravada and you have the Mahayana, and in the Mahayana you have the Tibetans and the Zens and, you know, and all this kind of stuff going on, right? So let's kind of go through this a little bit. In the Theravada tradition, in insight meditation, this is really within the Theravada tradition, the original teachings of the Buddha. And Theravada Buddhism considers the fifth precept to be a pretty clear prohibition of drinking. There really isn't wiggle room in here. In fact, Theravada tradition has a tendency to look at all the precepts pretty cut and dry. You know, this one about not killing? Well, you just don't kill. It's not like, you know, well, wait a minute, I can eat chicken and I'm still a vegetarian. No, you know, it's, right? No, it's... So, although the Theravada monks generally don't march around calling for prohibition, lay people are really discouraged from drinking. And in Southeast Asia, where Theravada Buddhism predominates, Sri Lanka and Burma and Thailand, the monastic sangha often calls for bars and liquor stores to be closed on certain holy days. And you'll find that a lot of Theravada Buddhists, particularly in Asia, they're very strict about this, and they just don't consume any alcohol. Well, in the Mahayana Buddhism, there are several schools, and there are differences within the Mahayana. Now, many of you are probably familiar with Thich Nhat Hanh, who's a Vietnamese Zen teacher. They're very clear on that. It's about abstention, period. You just abstain. And at Plum Village, which is Thich Nhat Hanh's center in France, it's just very cut and dried. In the book Thich Nhat Hanh's For a Future to Be Possible, Commentaries on the Five Wonderful Precepts, every time I've done a talk on the precepts, I've always held this book up. This is really, really good. It's talks by Thai and other teachers, including Jack Kornfield and others, Stephen Batchelor and so on, Richard Baker, Joan Halifax, Robert Aiken. They all have essays in here about the precepts. He says, mindful consumption is the object of this precept. We are what we consume. If we look deeply into the items that we consume every day, we will come to know our own nature very well. We have to eat, drink, consume. But if we do it unmindfully, we may destroy our bodies and our consciousness, showing ingratitude toward our ancestors, our parents, and future generations. The other thing that he talked about, I did a 21-day retreat over there, so I got to hear talks by him almost every day. And they talked about the effects of producing alcohol. And he said, what if the land that's used to grow all these grains for alcohol, it could be used for food. We could be planting food and feeding people. And interestingly enough, if you've ever been to Plum Village, it's right smack dab in the middle of wine country. I would go for walks down the roads when I had a chance, going by vast vineyards. It's kind of ironic. So just as abstaining from meat, for example, is a strong argument for ecology, so is abstaining from alcohol. You can use that argument there as well. So at the end of the 21-day retreat, we were offered given an invitation to actually take the five precepts. And there's a beautiful ceremony that's done at the end. And I got this little booklet, and they gave me a Dharma name and all this kind of stuff. Well, prior to the ceremony, they had discussions in the evenings that you could attend and talk about these precepts and ask questions. And when the question of the fifth precept came up, the monks that were there leading the discussion, they just said, no, there's no wiggle room on this. And I said, well, what if you just drink a little bit? Now, you have to understand, I'm a person in long-term recovery, okay? So I've been abstinent for quite a while. But this was back in 2000, before this happened, and I was drinking back in those days. And I said, what if you drink a little bit? And he says, it will affect your meditation. And I was pretty skeptical. And the comment that the monk said was, try it. Try it for a while. You will see the difference. So that was their perspective. So in this book, Thay also expands this. And Thay is the term of how he, that means teacher in the tradition. That's how they refer to Thich Nhat Hanh. He goes and takes this beyond just alcohol and street drugs. He says, this is the fifth precept, or fifth mindfulness practice, as they call it. Aware of the suffering caused by unmindful consumption, I vow to cultivate good health, both physical and mental, for myself, my family, and my society by practicing mindful eating, drinking, and consuming. I vow to ingest only items that preserve peace, well-being, and joy in my body and in my consciousness and in the collective body and consciousness of my family and society. I am determined not to use alcohol or any other intoxicant or to ingest foods or other items that contain toxins, such as TV programs, magazines, books, films, and conversations. I'm aware that to damage my body or my consciousness with these poisons is to betray my ancestors, my parents, my society, and future generations. I will work to transform violence, fear, anger, and confusion in myself and in society by practicing a diet for myself and for society. I understand that a proper diet is crucial for self-transformation and for the transformation of society. So you can see it really expands it out. And it makes sense, right? Because so many things can cloud our mind. So many things we can become intoxicated on. It's not just that beer or that glass of wine or whatever it is. So in the Tibetan tradition, which is sometimes referred to as the Vajrayana, there is a Western female lama called Lama Paldin. And she says, to refrain from taking intoxicants is one of the primary vows that lay people may take and that monastics have to uphold. One of the main reasons for not becoming intoxicated is that this can, and often does, lead to breaking other vows or straying from one's integrity. Another reason for not becoming intoxicated is that for many, intoxication obscures the clarity of mind. The clarity to understand and rest in one's true nature moment to moment. If one's mind has stabilized in true nature to the extent that its clarity is never obscured, then it makes no difference whether one takes in substances or not. So what is she saying? She's saying that you can get to a certain level of awareness It doesn't matter whether you drink or not. Different point of view. So, who decides? Some of you may be familiar with Chogyam Trungpa. He was one of the foremost Tibetan teachers to come to the United States and teach. He died in 1987. If you're familiar with Shambhala up in Boulder, Colorado, he founded that. Well, he was an alcoholic. He was also a sexual predator. And I met, what's her name? Help me, the famous Pema Chodron. I met Pema Chodron back in 1992. And I asked her about Chogyam Trungpa, because that was her primary teacher. And I said to her, how can you accept his behavior and what he did and be a student of his? I mean, it was kind of a ballsy thing to ask, you know? And she just looked at me. She said, you need to separate the teacher from the teachings. If you've ever read, some of his books are great. Oh, God. I can't think of the name of that one book now. This is really annoying.
Spiritual Materialism.
Yeah, Cutting Through Spiritual Materialism. It's brilliant. It's a brilliant teaching. And the man was an alcoholic. So, Lama Paldrin goes on, from the point of view of the Dharma training I was given, it is permissible, even when having taken this vow as a layperson, to enjoy a glass of wine occasionally. A distinction is made between intoxication, where one's clarity is compromised, and simply enjoying partaking of a substance. I also do not feel that occasionally utilizing a substance for transformational work is an obstacle for awakening. Is she talking about LSD here? It's been used for transformational awakening. It may be helpful, but honest discernment and consultation is needed if one engages in this way so that one does not fool oneself and go astray. So I guess this is called call your sponsor. I don't know. So you can see, and I lived at a Tibetan Buddhist center in New Mexico for a year. And it was interesting because, and this again is before I found recovery, before I realized I was an addict and I just can't use successfully. But I had tried to abstain at different periods of my life for extended periods of time on my own, right? And it just so happened for a year before I went into to live in this Tibetan center, I had not drunk any alcohol. And I got there, and the very first night, they're sitting around the table sharing a bottle of scotch. I went, what the hell? I'm in a Buddhist center? I've been abstaining, and now they're, here, Eddie, have some. It's like, what? It was cognitive dissonance for me. I couldn't understand it. And one time there was a retreat, and one of the lamas was sitting there drinking scotch like I drink green tea. So, what can I say? I'm not here to judge. Just saying. So, you know, it's different. And you're going to get different points of view. A lot of there are a lot of Western teachers in the Theravadan tradition. Remember, that's the one that's kind of more like by the book. A lot of them enjoy beverages and have a glass of wine and can do it just fine. You know, not a problem that I see. So here's what I know. I, Eddie, am prone to compulsive behavior. And I know I can't drink. And I know that if I decided to just even drink a little bit, you know, that part about just having occasionally, you know, until one's clarity is compromised, it's compromised right away. I mean, I'll feel it right away. And my goal is to have clarity of thinking. I don't want to dull my mind. Now, that's me. I can't project that on anyone else. It's That's my practice, not your practice. You have to decide, right? But I know for me, if I drank, it's Russian roulette. All bets are off. I don't know what's going to happen. Someone asked me one time, they said, well, you don't drink. Why don't you drink? I said, I'm allergic. They go, you are? And I go, yeah, I break out in handcuffs. That's not original, by the way. So I know in my life, I'm at risk of delusional thinking and acting out in ways that are not skillful if I do anything that takes me away from checking in and noticing what's happening in that moment. So it doesn't matter whether it's alcohol or whether tuning out into television or whatever it is. It, you know, I can find intoxicants in many ways. And to me, that's the way of looking at the precept. The fifth precept is to look on a broader scale. What are the kind of intoxicants? You know, what's in my life? What kind of relationship do I have with them? How does it impact me? And how does it put me at risk for violating the other precepts? Right? When I take mind-altering substances in any, even the most minute form, it's really going to alter my experience. So, I haven't talked about Japanese Zen. I also lived for 6 months at Green Gulch, which is a Japanese Zen center in the Bay Area. And I'm aware of the fact that some of the longtime residents there would sometimes partake in alcohol. But Reb Anderson, who's a senior teacher there, I don't think he did. And here's a quote by Reb. He said, in the course of our lives, most of us develop mental and physical habits that enable nice, cozy states of heedlessness. The challenge of working with the fifth precept is to identify what those are and deal with them. From this perspective, the question of whether to abstain from alcohol entirely or drink in moderation is an individual one that requires some spiritual maturity and self-honesty. And I really think that sums it up well. So, it's not a commandment, it's a practice. That's what it is.